Welcome to The Latest on the Law, a podcast of the Boston Bar Association. The Commonwealth's premier legal association, the BBA is home to over 15,000 members and 140 institutional partners consisting of law firms, corporations, government agencies, legal aid organizations, and law schools. Visit us at bostonbar.org to learn more.
And thank you to the BBA for having us. It is my pleasure to serve as the chair of the Tort Insurance Litigation Committee, a steering committee at the BBA. We love discussing all things tort and insurance, and certainly e-discovery and the implications of AI falls within our bailiwick. It is opening day, and we have an all-star lineup of panelists to discuss that topic today. And I am thrilled to turn things over to my co-moderator, Jackie DeGrandpre.
Thanks so much, Matt. Hey, everybody. Thank you so very much for joining us this afternoon. As Matt said, we have a great selection of panelists here, subject matter experts in e-discovery and artificial intelligence. It's really going to be a great, great discussion. Without further ado, I'm going to introduce myself, and I'm going to have my folks introduce themselves as well with the other panelists, and then we're going to jump right in because we have a lot to discuss today. So my name is Jackie DeGrandpre. I am a shareholder in GT's Boston office. I focus on medical device and pharmaceutical litigation, defense litigation. I'm an e-discovery attorney at GT. That's actually how I started at GT 12 years ago. I am also the co-chair of the product liability section at the BBA. So I work with Matt quite frequently. And with that, I would like my longtime friends and colleagues, Jeff Green and Liz Georgopoulos, to go ahead, give us a short introduction of themselves and their practice.
Hey, everyone. Jeff Green, Greenberg Traurig, Boston. I'm the co-chair of the litigation department here and also co-chair of the e-discovery practice group worldwide at Greenberg Traurig, and very pleased to be here.
And hi, everyone. I'm Liz Georgopoulos. I'm an associate in GT's Boston office and a member of the litigation, e-discovery, data privacy, and artificial intelligence practice groups. And with that, I think I'll turn it over to Linda Banks.
Hi, I'm Linda Banks. I'm the Director of eDiscovery Services at Robbins Kaplan. I have been with the firm for quite a few years, and we have a great deal of experience with technology and how to use it to make sure that we're doing things efficiently during document reviews. Tyler?
And I am Tyler Simmons, a discovery attorney at Robbins Kaplan. I've been doing that for about 12 years, a lot of financial securities litigation, insurance, some other different discovery matters. Should be interesting to see where we've been and where we're going on all of that. I think Eric is last but not least.
Yeah, well, or as Jeff Green would tell you, last and least. But thank you very much for having me and allowing me to participate in this presentation. So I am the Vice President of Global Advisory Services and Strategic Solutions for KL Discovery. I am an attorney by education, but for better or for worse, found my way to the litigation management and technology side 25 or so years ago. I've been with KL Discovery now for 16 years, with a heavy focus, both on the consulting side, but at doing a lot of expert testimony work and working with with folks like the teams at Greenberg, in e-discovery, ESI, complex litigations, I guess is the best way to put it.
Great. And thank you again so much to our panelists for joining today and sharing their wealth of knowledge and their experience with us. So we're going to look just very quickly at the agenda because, again, we want to jump right into these topics and these questions. So we're going to talk about the developments in e-discovery and artificial intelligence in 2024. We're going to get into using artificial intelligence within e-discovery, and then we're going to shift to some key takeaways and best practices, some highlights of what our panelists are going to be discussing today. And for whatever time we have left at the end, we're going to take some questions. Hopefully we'll have enough time. But with that, we're going to kick us off and we're going to talk about developments in e-discovery in 2024. I'm going to open this up to all of our panelists and ask them, guys, what are we seeing as the top five trends in e-discovery?
I'll probably start with one, Jackie. Continuing the growth of collections and, you know, data sources and collaboration software, whether it's Slack or Teams or Zoom or whatever, gone are the days, obviously, where you had, just a collection, custodian collection was basically, their laptop data and their email. Now it's, I think the scope and breadth of what's possible in terms of data sources is rapidly increasing and continues to do so as these productivity platforms continue to develop and get more sophisticated. My experience, and I'd be very interested to hear Eric and Linda's experience on this as well, is many of these sort of the newer softwares, they do not lend themselves necessarily to easy collection and sort of processing. And so the challenges that I see, whether you call it cloud or productivity platforms, it's changing the dynamic, from my perspective. So I would say from, looking for through my lens, that's the biggest challenge for 2024.
Linda, you want to go first?
Yeah, I would just say I agree definitely with the fact that it is a very big challenge for our clients to control and collect and handle for, maybe a very small set of responsive information, things like Slack. We really, it's just big volumes and there's a lot of, necessary coordination between the IT people who are handling that on the back end and the users who don't even really understand, potentially what's being saved, what isn't. So it's definitely for us one of our bigger challenges.
Yeah. And the thing I would add there is that, the existence of these platforms is just really one component. These platforms, for all of the benefit they bring from a business productivity perspective, represent actually a lot of additional complexity into the e-discovery process, particularly, and not to call out Microsoft, but I'll use Microsoft 365 as the example, is, there's a lot of Microsoft language and industry language around being able to use the native tools within the Microsoft 365 environment for discovery purposes. There are some value added components there. And I mean, we're not going to dive into, we could spend hours talking about just that. But the reality is that, there are a lot of complexities and there are limitations. And as more clients start to feel more empowered to do more on their own in these platforms, on the discovery side, from the provider side, from the, and on the review side, we're discovering that some of these clients don't really have a full grasp of what the complications are and experiencing downstream issues. So it becomes even more important to leverage your resources like counsel, like the experts from your providers, to ensure that the not only the collection processes are defensible, but what you're getting out is actually what you need.
And another thing, I think, Erica, to that point is I just had most recently a request where, produce all Slack data. And so we went in and, grabbed Slack data from that person. And then the follow-up request was, no, we want to see every Slack channel that that person is involved in and all communications in all those channels. And so what it became was a much broader request. And so I think there's probably some definition and initial scoping that needs to be done, sort of negotiation as far as what's the true scope of this discovery going to be on these kinds of platforms. Because I think we can easily see how orders of magnitude more data could end up being impacted as these systems, continue to proliferate.
Yeah, and just to kind of use Slack as another example, this is an area where the scope of discovery often gets blown up, because a client can, any client can go in and say, we've got, 10 gigabytes of Slack messages. The reality is that dashboard, that information that the client's looking at is literally just the individual messages, doesn't incorporate attachments, anything like that. So we, in our experience, we've seen the actual Slack volume explode. I won't even use the term expand, explode by anywhere from 10 to, you know, to 100 times based upon the nature of the attached files. So it is a very, again, complex, you know, platform, you know, once you get into the back end, and it can really have a significant impact on the e-discovery process. And that is not, you know, so different when you start to talk about other platforms like, you know, project management platforms in construction litigation, for example, or when you can start, we can talk about medical records. When you start to talk about, we can talk about the challenges of medical record discovery to begin with, but there's a lot of definitional issues that come into play in defining what's actually part of a record for discovery purposes. So there, again, a lot of components that come into play, and this is the reason why experts are important, whether they're counsel or from your provider, to kind of make sure that scoping is being done in an appropriate fashion.
Yeah, and just to add, I think all of these challenges can be addressed by advising clients very early on how they actually implement these tools and use these collaboration tools and structure channels within Slack, et cetera, so that they are making sure they're preserving privilege and not allowing third parties potentially to join particular channels, and also implement retention policies so that they can manage the large volumes of data that they may ultimately need to collect in litigation. So it's also important, as these tools are becoming increasingly popular, to try to work with clients to mitigate the risk associated with their use. And that's something that I've been dealing with a lot lately this past year.
Yeah. The one other thing I'd throw out there that, is the what I'm seeing as a significant increase in the indication of structured data sources in discovery, and that represents a whole different set of challenges. And again, not to derail this conversation, because I know we've got a lot of things we want to cover, but that's just something else that has to be taken into consideration, because the structured data requires very specialized skills, not only to get the data out in a usable way, but then how do you actually leverage that in the discovery process?
Eric, if I can just jump in. So for the uninformed, when you say structured data source, can you just give some exemplars of what you mean by that?
Think about an SAP system or any type of ERP system where you've got either human resources information, financial information. It's a database, basically. Mm-hmm. And when you start, in the old days where a database was just simply, a few tables, it was actually easier. But in today's world, when we're talking about relational databases, and you could have literally hundreds of tables of information. And when you click a button in that platform or make a request for a report in that platform, the system is basically pointing to hundreds of different fields across, dozens or hundreds of tables to kind of show you what you've asked for. And in some discovery requests, that may be all you need is to be able to run a report. We've had scenarios where we've actually had to go take full extracts of a database to be able to parse that data for the requested discovery information, because there's no effective reporting mechanism to get the necessary data out. So it can become very intense and very complex from that perspective. So think about it, it's large scale information that can be literally millions to tens or hundreds of millions of rows of data if you were to kind of parse it out in, for lack of a better to put it, a spreadsheet type of format.
That's helpful.
So there's one question that I do want to direct to Ms. Georgopoulos over here, because I know this is her bread and butter. This is what she does day in and day out for our clients. So Liz, how can we ensure that our e-discovery processes and collection efforts are reasonable and defensible as technologies such as AI evolve?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thanks, Jackie. I think first and foremost, especially as the rise of AI is becoming increasingly common and proliferating, is to keep in mind that AI cannot replace humans. So a lot of what we normally would do in e-discovery, things like conduct custodian interviews and really, you know, do a deep dive on our custodians, et cetera, prior to our collection efforts should remain the same. Don't forget the fundamentals. But also, it's important to really understand the limitations of any AI tools that are being used, and clearly defining their uses and impermissible uses. So development of policies and procedures that very clearly outline responsibilities whenever an AI tool is used in e-discovery or in research, whatever it may be, early case assessment is very important, so that both, you know, at the law firm level and at the client level, everyone knows there's transparency as to what's happening. And there's also an awareness as to where validation is necessary. And there, in that way, you mitigate any risk, because these, all of these tools are very imperfect. And, you know, one thing kind of to keep in mind is, you know, early case assessment tools are becoming increasingly common. But again, as I stated, that, you know, that shouldn't negate the need for things like custodian interviews. AI tools can be very effective in helping manage large volumes of data and helping us find some key documents early on. But a lot of our best practices in e-discovery really remain the same. They just can happen quicker. And, you know, by clearly defining, updating our e-discovery protocols and processes to account for those tools very transparently, and making sure that our validation quality control efforts are adjusted to take into account AI, I think are very important as, you know, the e-discovery world's changing and getting impacted by, you know, various tools that are getting implemented.
Thank you, Liz.
Yeah, if I could just add something real quick. I mean, and Liz hit on a really, you know, important aspect, you know, about ESI protocols. You know, this is really an area that, you know, we see can be a huge benefit, but can also be very problematic. It's really critical that you have an understanding of what you're committing to in your protocol. Because, I mean, we've seen scenarios where parties have agreed to certain elements that they didn't really understand the downstream impacts in the e-discovery process to. So it's really important that, you know, that those things, you know, be vetted and kind of really thought about in the operational context versus just the, you know, the context of strategy.
Right. I mean, from an e-discovery, you know, person's perspective, the people that have to get the data in the database, you definitely want to make sure that, you know, technically speaking, your STIP covers, your ESI protocol or stipulation covers the technical side, but also that strategy. And, you know, for when we counsel attorneys on how to, like, to respond to, you know, another side's either concern about using, you know, predictive coding or AI in a matter, you know, we really want to focus on how is it going to work? Like, how can you make sure validation happens? And then technically speaking, what are we getting out of it? And also technically speaking, how can you understand it? But it's never our first opinion or response to say, you know, somebody can't use technology assisted review or they can't use AI. It's really, how do we make it work? And so you do want to make sure that those protocols cover both that technical side and then that strategic side of how is it going to work for them and for you.
Thank you, Linda. So, you know, I want to ask the panelists, so what is still working in e-discovery? And what are the things that are just not working anymore that we cannot go back to? I know, this is a loaded question.
I mean, I'll start is you know, the thing that I see as a real risk is parties and candidly counsels not taking into consideration the changing data landscape. As Jeff mentioned, you know, there was a time where all you really had to be concerned about was, even going back before laptops, was a desktop machine. And, you know, what we would consider now as archaic email platforms. And today that's just not the case, because you've got, You've got personal devices, you've got tablets, you've got mobile devices, you've got all of these, you know, these cloud-based platforms that you know, individuals may be leveraging, you know, that you know, may or may not be connected to, you know, to their core systems. It's really a function of understanding, you know, the data landscape. And we often, you know, suggest creating a data and systems inventory, you know, specific to this, the scope of the matter, in order to kind of understand what you actually are dealing with. And goes back to Liz's, you know, comments on custodian interviews. That's a critical part of the process.
I'll follow on that. And there are some of us on this call with enough gray hair to remember the days where we went in and just, you know, you went into a client with a bunch of empty boxes and you took folders off shelves and you put them in the boxes and you had them copied and so on. And those days are gone. And the linear review of those files is also largely gone. So, you know, obviously understanding the data landscape, I think, is really important, but also understanding how technology, you know, how we can embrace technology to assist. And, you know, I think of a case where I just worked on within the last couple of weeks where we had 6.8 million files. We collected data. We had 6.8 million files and we had to produce it. We had to produce relevant documents within 5 days. Court order, nothing we can do about it, 5 days. And we were able to leverage a variety of different technologies, layering TAR on top of search terms, using you know, a variety of applications, working with Eric and his team. But we were able to identify over the course very quickly, roughly 100,000 documents that needed to be reviewed. And we ultimately made a production of a few thousand documents at the end of the day. But that would be impossible 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago, that kind of productivity in terms of, you know, getting through that number of documents. Now, to be sure, we're not there yet. I mean, we talk about AI and TAR and, you know, technology assisted review and computer assisted learning. Those are, you know, AI based applications. We're not yet at a point where it's, you know, sort of push the easy button and, you know, the system will just spit out the documents it wants or that you're looking for. We're not there yet. We're getting closer, but we're still, you know, we still have some time. So I think to you know, number one, understand, Eric is exactly right, understanding your data environment, that's key. But then I think looking at the technology, available technology with your vendor partners, you know, with folks like Linda, who like all of us has seen the growth of technology, but say to ask questions to people like Eric and Linda, say, okay, what's the best way to get through this in the most efficient economical manner? Right. And that I think is really key too.
Yeah. You know, what I'll say is working is collaboration. When we see lawyers collaborating, because again, as the receiving party of data, I don't want to be dumped on. I mean, so we would rather that somebody find, you know, the richest set of documents first when they're producing to us and produce those ideally first. Keep, you know, the litigation and the discovery moving. So collaboration, when opposing parties collaborate, that is by far, you know, the greatest scenario that we can imagine in e-discovery, get things moving. The technology assisted review and AI, you know, people again are seemingly willing to consider it. And that is great too, because we can't go back to those days where no matter the volume of data, we have to put eyes on everything. I mean, that just is not defensible. It's not feasible. It doesn't make sense. So, you know, when does it make sense and how do we implement it?
Yeah. And Jackie, the other part of your question was what has stayed the same, what hasn't changed. Mm-hmm. And, you know, at the core, the discovery process hasn't changed, right? Requirements in discovery, while there's, you know, we've acknowledged that there's these new electronic documents and, you know, under the rule, you know, the ABA model rules and in many states now there's a requirement for technical competence around what is out there. At the core of the discovery process, the rules of engagement have not changed. They've been the same for decades. So that is our consistency across this spectrum. Yeah, that we have to, as you know, as kind of the consultative experts in this arena have to guide our clients on, is that there are core requirements here, and it doesn't matter whether you're talking about Slack or you're talking about a box of paper documents, right? So that I think is something that often gets lost in these conversations, because we get so focused on the technologies that, you know, again, at the core, you know, the rules haven't really changed significantly, if you really think about it. And then beyond that, you know, is as Linda is talking about this kind of concept of collaboration. I mean, Sedona as a, you know, as an entity that produces non-legally binding treatises is probably one of the most often cited sources of thought leadership in our industry. And the whole idea of the collaboration proclamation around council don't have to like each other, but they should cooperate and collaborate in the process is another thing that if you look at the court opinions, and as not being a practicing attorney, I'm not going to offer a legal opinion, but but if you look at the dicta from the courts over the years, you know, they consistently, whether they mention Sedona or not, you know, point to this need and requirement for counsel to cooperate at mm-hmm. some level. And again, that's something that has not changed.
And I'll jump in on that, Eric, because I think it's a great point. I mean, the standard hasn't changed, right? I mean, the rules have changed a little bit from like a proportionality perspective, but in every case, we still have to, you know, conduct a reasonable and defensible effort to find the relevant materials relating to claims and defenses. So you start there, and I 100% agree with you in terms of baseline. You know, back in the day, you know, the only tracking we had to do was, did that box get copied, right? And did it get returned to the client? Now I think the rules have changed, because in order to have that reasonable and defensible process, I think you need to be able to justify it. And what that means from my perspective, and I'll let Liz can weigh in on this too, because she's phenomenal at this, is, you know, how do you track, you know, what the data sources you've got from custodians, and then how do you track your process? So let's say you're using keyword search terms, did you test those terms? Did you create multiple versions of the terms so as to check whether they were over-inclusive or under-inclusive? Did you test, did you QC null sets to see if there was anything you're missing? And if there's a takeaway, one certain takeaway is, I think it's important to track your process to show, you know, the how you got to your end result, the documents you produced, such that it was defensible. And you can say, hey, look, we ran 8 different sets of search terms, and the first term was way too inclusive. The next one was too exclusive. And you want to be able to justify that to the court if you ever get called the carpet on, on your discovery practices. And I'm not suggesting, you know, revealing work product, but I do think you want to have in your back pocket proof that you did that reasonable and defensible investigation. Now, I'll turn it over to Liz or ask Liz, how do you do that in what Eric says correctly is this new data environment? How do you keep track of all the different custodians, all the different sources that, you know, that need to be processed? What's your best approach for dealing with that?
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. So I always like to build what I call a custodian matrix and a data source matrix. And at the end of the day, I mean, that's really a spreadsheet. You can structure it how you want that tracks absolutely every communication you've had with a particular custodian, all the efforts taken with respect to a specific data source. And that way you have a very clear documentation of all the efforts that have been taken. And so that you don't lose sight of any of the, you know, good faith efforts you took in order to make sure you have a reasonable and defensible approach. So while it takes some time up front and is tedious, it definitely helps in the event that there are any discovery, you know, fights in court. If you have everything in your back pocket in a custodian matrix, data source matrix, you have all the information available to you. You haven't forgotten it. And you can show the court all of your good faith efforts in making sure that your process was reasonable and defensible.
Thanks so much, guys. We have so much to cover. We're going to move on to our next topic. Matt, I know you're going to take this one over.
Indeed. So we've talked a lot about artificial intelligence. Jeff had just mentioned, you know, TAR, predictive coding. So I want to kick to the panelists sort of a question, two parts, and the slides will break this sort of in the first instance. What are the developments in AI broadly that you're seeing in 2024, and then sort of unique to the e-discovery space? What are sort of either case law developments or particular, you know, AI tools that you're seeing leveraged to make our lives as attorneys and your lives as the folks dealing with the data sets easier?
Yeah, I'll start this one. I think one trend that I've been noticing is certainly the rise of generative AI, and I always struggle saying that word. You know, of course, technologies like TAR have been around for a while, but technologies like ChatGPT, I think, have really become more common over the past year or so, and that is certainly creating a lot of challenges, especially for attorneys that are not aware of the limitations, and that can certainly present a lot of risk. I mean, I think we've been seeing several cases, one even out of the Second Circuit this past January, where attorneys have been sanctioned for citing fake cases in their briefs. And there's nothing more embarrassing than having to explain to the court why you did something like that, and saying you didn't understand that the case was fake is not a good excuse, of course. So I think that's something that we've been seeing a lot of in the AI world. And I think it's important that there's a lot of education, you know, educating our clients. And this is a little bit outside of the e-discovery world, but as they incorporate technologies like ChatGPT or assessing whether they should, the policies and procedures that I talked a little bit about become increasingly important, because clients, as well as law firms, all of us really need to understand what kind of generative AI technologies mitigate risk and are acceptable for handling sensitive data, personal information, client data, and which ones should not be used. And like ChatGPT, of course, should not be used for sensitive, inputting confidential information. But there are a lot of private AI tools, and vendor partners are developing a lot of these tools where, you know, law firms or, you know, clients can create their own private instances of AI technologies that certainly mitigate any risk and, you know, data privacy, cybersecurity concerns, and can be very useful. So I don't know if Eric can probably speak a little bit to some of those tools and private instances of AI tools. But I think that's something that we'll be seeing even more, in 2024 and certainly beyond. And so it's important to really understand the different types of AI technologies that are available to us so that we are able to mitigate risk.
Sorry, Eric.
Just to piggyback on that really quickly, what Liz was saying is, you know, we're hearing clients asking, you know, we want to save money. How do we do this? But at the same time, saving money on the front end, right, but not doing it quite properly is going to cost them more money in the back end. So it's like, it's always that push and pull with the client. Yes, we understand you want to save money, but at the same time, we got to make sure that we're doing this properly. It's defensible. And that might take a little bit more money, but in the end, you could be spending a lot more having to explain to the court, hey, you know, we didn't do this. You have to go back and do this entire thing over again. I mean, it could be a complete nightmare. So that's one thing, you know, definitely to explain to clients is yes, like, there are some capabilities of AI that might be cost efficient, but it might not be in the best, you know, best use of this case for, you know, for what we need to use it for. And Eric, I'll turn it back over to you.
Yeah. So, I think Liz talked about having, you know, policies, protocols, having standards in place and being able to do the authentication and validate. And we've mentioned validation throughout the course of our conversation so far. You know, again, yes, we talk about things changing, but it came into play with tools like predictive coding, for example. You know, that is very translatable to this concept of advanced AI. And one of the things I'd like to be very clear about, and this is a soapbox I often get on, and the soapbox keeps getting bigger, is, you know, we've been leveraging AI for over 10 years, right? By definition, email threading is a form of artificial intelligence, right? So, you know, we've been leveraging advancing technologies consistently, you know, over the course of the last, you know, 15, 20 years even, right? So as we learn more, we develop more, we create new toys to play with, we need to be able to apply those same standards. And we've already talked about how the general standards don't change, right? But it does become more complex. And the ability to do things like authentication and validation on large language models, for example, is a real challenge, which is one of the reasons, why I think Jeff mentions, I don't want to put words in his mouth, is that, you know, we're not quite there yet. So there's a lot of people putting a lot of tools into the market, talking about a lot of developments, but we're still trying to figure out the defensibility process around a lot of these tools. And I think that's part of our real current challenge. So we can talk a lot about that. There's no definitive answer. Like with predictive coding, you run illusion sets, you do sampling, you do all kinds of different things. How are we going to do that with these generative AI models and these large language models behind them? We're still navigating those waters, and we probably will be for the next, I think it's going to be more aggressive than what a lot of others think. So in the next 18 to 24 months, I think we'll see some definitive, modeling and tools available to us to be able to really comfortably defensively do this. It's a very dynamic environment. It's kind of like Moore's Law, for those of you who aren't familiar, it's where the short definition of Moore's Law is technology changes faster than we can keep pace with. We will constantly be playing catch up with what the technical capabilities are and matching our legal requirements to the technologies.
And just as quickly as the technologies are changing, so is the guidance, laws, and regulations. Right. So one, big point to take home is to make sure you're constantly checking the laws, regulations, court rules on AI, e-discovery, everything, to make sure you're not running afoul of any of those. We see it a lot with cross-border discovery. I know we work with a lot of international clients, so that's a really key thing that some clients don't think about, and how laws differ, privacy laws differ in different countries with e-discovery. And some states, some countries are more advanced with their AI laws and regulations, and some are falling behind. But you have to be absolutely certain in the jurisdiction that you're working in to make sure that you're doing things, defensively and correctly.
Try and control myself a little bit here, because we can start, if we get into the regulation conversation too deeply, that's a whole nother webinar.
Yeah. Sorry, I just wanted to add, it's not an easy button. There's no easy button. And, we thought, people think predictive coding was an easy button, but as Tyler and I can explain in great detail, if anybody ever asks, there is so much, like Eric already said, that goes into setting up even a TAR, a technology assisted review process, validating it, training it. So lawyers still have to have oversight on that. And there's nothing different in, a true AI model. What worries me as a person like in the trenches is that lawyers understood they had to talk to somebody like a person in e-discovery to implement a TAR process. And with the AI models, it, you know, people think, I understand ChatGPT, I understand what it's doing, and so potentially less likely to involve technical experts. And then you really do lose oversight, understanding of what's really happening behind the scenes with an AI model. So, you know, as the person, again, who's in the trenches, in the weeds, you know, my concern is when you either have clients pushing for it or you as a lawyer are pushing for using artificial intelligence, make sure you bring in those experts that understand risks, benefits, how to measure it, where possible, you know, what it's capable of, what it isn't capable of. And then as Liz has mentioned already, don't ever forget those basics. You still have to preserve data. You still have to make sure you're doing custodian interviews, documenting what you've collected and why, and what search terms you've run. So just my input there.
And I think there's another element, but sorry to interrupt, the aspect of educating the court, right? And, you know, I'll offend Eric here by saying, you know, bring your geek to court day when you have to explain these complicated AI models. But, you know, I think it was 12 years ago that Judge Peck came out with, you know, sort of the big decision that predictive coding was okay, and that if you follow these processes, you're good. And that was, that sort of opened the floodgates in terms of the, you know, the approved use of predictive coding. The technologies that are available today are more sophisticated, and we're seeing layering of different technologies. And so I think, and this goes to obviously documenting your processes and so on, but you have to be able to defend it, number one, but also you have to be able to explain it to the court. And you say, Judge, this is a little bit different. You know, here's how we did this. But educating the court remains a very important piece to the puzzle, because I do think you have to defend the existence of your discovery process, and how you got there obviously depends on the technology you're using, but that's where the subject matter experts come into play. So you can say, you know, hey, this is how we did it. And we do still have judges in the Commonwealth and, you know, across the country who are not e-discovery sophisticated savvy. And that's not a knock on the judges. It's just, they don't do this in and out every day. So I think one of the things that you should look to as you defend your process is also look to educate the courts on how you got there at the end of the day, if you're ever challenged.
Yeah. And I think, in addition to being able to describe it to a judge, having a clearly defined plan when you're going into initial.
Oh, Tara, I think you muted yourself. And
that way you muted yourself.
There we go. It also completely got rid of the entire webinar. Okay. I think having a plan going in and so that you can clearly define what tools you're going to be using when you're in the meet and confer, because your understanding of, you're going to be using an active learning model to manage the data. Opposing counsel might not even understand, you know, entirely what that is. They might have a more primitive sort of TAR model in their mind. And you can get in a situation then where you have a plan, you know what you're doing, but if you haven't communicated it to the other side, they might think you're doing something completely different. Right. And down the road, now you have a, you know, pretty major conflict over that. And I think the other thing to kind of remember on that front is that in the end, these are tools. They're not necessarily solutions. We still need to use them as tools. And it's not, you know, it's not simply we're going to apply an active learning model to this data and that's all the documents. We do have, we do need to have a plan for how we're going to use those tools.
Right.
And I think the understanding too is, you know, plans are going to change. You know, you're going to start doing something one way, find out it might not work. So both parties have to understand things can change and come to agreement on, hey, this is what's going to happen. We're going to talk through it. We're going to, you know, try to cooperate because that's what the courts require. Discovery motions can get very expensive for our clients. So it's best for both sides to understand that going through the process, it might change. It might have to change. And it will be beneficial for both parties to be cooperative. And again, that's why it's good to be transparent and you know, let the other side know here's what we're doing. Here's why we're doing it. Get that agreement early on with the understanding that that plans can change. So I think we're going to go ahead and move on. I know we've been talking a ton about, obviously, e-discovery and artificial intelligence and how to basically, you know, negotiating the use of the AI tools with opposing counsel. We obviously were very lucky to have plaintiff side and defendant side here to give their perspectives. We've definitely talked about that a lot today and how to make the use of AI tools defensible. So now I kind of want to touch on what tools and AI programs have worked best for your cases. And are there any downfalls? And give the audience some an idea of like what has worked well and what has kind of not worked so well.
Well, I'll start from the perspective of, you know, no two tools are created equal. And there's no perfect technology. And these are two mantras that I live by, you know, day in and day out. The reality is you have to match your technology to your need. And if you don't understand if you don't have at least a base level, broad scope understanding of what your technology is capable of, you're likely going to find yourself with challenges. Whether you've overbought technology for a particular, you know, engagement, or you've underbought based upon what the needs are, or you're not leveraging it correctly. Those are all of the components, right? So I think for me, you know, when I'm speaking with clients is, you know, that we've talked about, but understanding not only the scope, but the nature of the engagement is really critical in aligning your technology as a solution. And as Tyler mentioned, these are tools that are part of a larger solution package. So there's no tool out there that's going to be a one size fits all for everybody, everywhere, in every engagement. So I think that for me is one of the most critical elements that candidly often is lost in translation. You know, you have a matter like Jeff referred to earlier. Mm-hmm. Where it was a mountain of data that has to be, you know, managed in a very finite amount of time. And you're going to need to, I mean, there's no way to do that with just human bodies. I mean, you know, very rarely are you going to be able to find, you know, 500 bodies you can throw at a set of data, you know, on short notice, right? But leveraging technology, being able to defensively and effectively get through it is a possibility. But if you have, you know, a small matter with, you know, 500 documents, you know, still makes sense to use technology, but you may not need, you know, a full powered, you know, AI backed platform, right? So again, I'm a big believer that technology is always going to be a value add, but it's right sizing to the need to a large extent.
So, you know, just for our, what we've seen great use of at our firm is a combo of larger matters, early case assessment, really making sure, you know, that we're not feeding to the attorneys just everything we've collected right away. So figuring out, you know, what the likely set is, and then definitely active learning has been a great resource for us. Tyler can speak to more of that. On even some smaller cases, you know, I'd say, you know, 15,000 documents, what we use it for a lot is really, again, just to figure out what do I have in the set that's interesting? What can I get at the rich set of documents early on? Maybe I am still going to look at all of these because it is only 10,000 or 20,000 documents, but I'm going to find out a lot more about my case pretty quick if, you know, I'm using something like an active learning model. So those have been our two big time and money savers are the combo of early case assessment and active learning.
Yeah, and to Linda's point, I mean, as we're watching the, you know, the evolution of new technologies, leveraging advanced analytics, leveraging generative AI, you know, I think, you know, particularly in that early data, early case assessment phase, we'll start to see the ability to leverage these tools to more efficiently, I shouldn't say more efficiently, to more expeditiously identify key sets of documents in the data set. Right. by leveraging intelligent prompt writing, right? And this kind of, I mean, I think this is an overarching thing for me, and I think we kind of brushed on it earlier, is the human component is never going to go away. At least I don't think in our lifetimes. you know, eventually maybe the robots and the computers take over the world, science fiction becomes reality, all that kind of fun stuff. But you know, what I do think is going to happen is we're going to be able to create significant efficiencies leveraging technologies that are going to change what the human requirements are. So first level reviewers at some point, whether they're in the firms or through providers. But what you are going to need are people that have the technical capability, the wherewithal to craft usable and effective prompts. You know, there's already a career path out there for prompt engineers. So I think that is going to be one of the areas where young attorneys are going to be able to develop very useful skill sets, you know, as we kind of move into this new era, individuals with the ability to quality control this work.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, there's a lot of impacts there, you know, that I think come into play.
So we're coming up really close to time. And thank you, Eric. And thank you, Linda, for your insight on that. And I want to make sure that we can get to our key takeaways and our best practices to wrap things up at the end and then have some time for questions. So I have one very burning question for Eric, and I know it's on the top of everybody's minds. When will AI be accepted across the board? When can we see this happening?
So, I mean, we're already seeing it. Jeff mentioned, you know, the first opinion for predictive coding came out about, you know, 12 years ago or so, you know, but to this day, the actual technology behind predictive coding has never been challenged. So, you know, will we see challenges to this technology? It's always possible. But what's more likely is there's going to be challenges to how the technology is applied, processes and protocols, the validation efforts. So my opinion is, and I know this is not necessarily a popular opinion, is that we're already seeing this come into play. I think that within the next 18 to 24 months, we're going to see the application of these tools in a more holistic way and start to gain acceptance. And somebody's going to challenge how somebody used it. And then we're going to be looking for the next judge pick, whoever it may be, to offer, you know, an opinion from the bench saying, listen, as long as you follow this general process, this is acceptable. That I think we'll probably see in the next, you know, in the next 2 to 3 years. We're not going to see it immediately. I'd be surprised. But I think that within the next 3 years, we're going to start to see significant adoption of these technologies. And it's going to align to some extent with the way that the regulatory landscape is changing as well, which is changing quickly. We're not going to have the same, you know, kind of drawn out adoption that we saw with predictive coding. And again, not necessarily a popular opinion, but I also think that this is tied very closely to the generational impacts, where we've got the users and those moving into leadership position, both on the technology side as well as into the firm side, are younger individuals who have grown up with technology, are more comfortable with it, are less risk averse with respect to technology, and it's going to expedite the adoption rates.
And that will be the same thing with the judges as well, I feel like. All right. Well, we're going to move into our key takeaways and best practices. And of course, we welcome our panelists to jump right in and let us know any additional thoughts that they have. Of course, you know, predictive coding, TAR, we've been using AI in discovery for years. I think that there's a misconception that AI is like new. You know, a lot of people say, oh, this is new for e-discovery. Well, it's not. We've been using it for years. It's just more programs are coming out and it's being, you know, more accepted, which is excellent, I think, for all of us. You know, the good thing, you know, I think we can take away from this and all us attorneys, we can be comfortable that AI is not yet replacing humans, right? And the courts have made it very clear that humans, us, we're still the gatekeepers of the information. And it's really on us. The onus is on us. The burden is on us to make sure that we're putting forth everything that's legitimate, that is true, that is correct, that is accurate, that is defensible. I know you guys have heard defensibility this entire panel presentation, and that's really the key. That is not change, because technology really is only as good as the validation and the analysis of your raw data set. As Jeff indicated earlier, we still don't have that magic button to just press and get, you know, the relevant documents that we need. Maybe we'll be there, as Eric says, in about 2 to 3 years. That would be excellent. I'm sure our clients would be very happy with the lower cost, with discovery and efficiencies. And as Liz highlighted, really still use your fundamental ECA tools. Those are going to be the basis. That's going to be your process. That's how you're going to explain to the court and opposing counsel. This is how I'm validating what I'm producing to you. And we know the importance of that. You want to make sure you have a defensible approach and process and mapping, just like, you know, Liz has said, we can say it till we're, you know, blue in the face here. Making sure you're writing everything down, keeping your custodian matrices. I still have custodial interview notes from 10 years ago, handwritten for that matter, that I keep around just in case. And again, I just want to highlight, you know your jurisdiction, know your data privacy and your AI laws and regulations. You don't want to run afoul of your applicable rules. Matt, I'll hand it over to you to go through some best practices.
Thank you so much. I'm just impressed that you still have handwritten notes from 10 years ago. You got to digitize those. Come on, in the spirit of this panel.
Scan them in.
But I digress. So when I was thinking about sort of wrap up takeaways, you know, as a younger attorney still at heart, I'd like to think, despite doing this for 10 plus years now, you know, how can younger attorneys, and I hate cliches too, but bring value, add value to this process? And I think the best way to do that, right? AI, despite all of its advantages, is not draft. I mean, well, I probably could draft a litigation hold, but it can't negotiate the scope of a litigation hold with opposing counsel or with a client and discuss the implications of a particular litigation hold and why certain, you know, data sets have to be retained and why certain retention protocols are in place. So younger attorneys, get, if you don't have a template litigation hold, find one, you know, go on your iManager, whatever your you know, firm's database is, and make a great one and bring that to your next matter that the partner comes in and says, I'd like you to help out with this case venued in, say, Washington State or wherever it is. And then in that same venue, right, I would recommend finding if there is a template ESI protocol in place, if there's a template protective order in place. We didn't talk much about war stories, but I mentioned to the panel, I think I mentioned to Jack before we got on, I had a COVID-19 business interruption litigation in Washington State Court, where it took the parties two years to agree to the terms of an ESI stip. I mean, that's insane. And there was I'll go even further, right? There was a template ESI protocol actually in place in the United States District Court for Washington that we started with as a template. And despite that, it took the parties 2 years to agree. And again, AI can help with that, but we as lawyers, for better or worse, will be the ones actually negotiating those agreements. And my advice to the younger attorneys and those young at heart like myself is become expert at those pieces that are essential to the litigation process.
Do our panelists want to add in anything? I know we're close to time. Does anyone want to add anything else?
I think, Jackie, just one simple process is, and Jackie, I love to hear those custodian interviews, and I know who I know who those interviews were with 10 years ago. But document your process from the time you do custodian interviews to, as Liz says, the custodial matrix to the QC work you did on your you know, your TAR, CAL environment, to the search terms you used. And, you know, it's really important that cases large or small, you are able to defend, you know, defend the existence of your discovery process. And that's how you avoid motions to compel. And that's how you avoid motions for sanction. So, you know, just be double, triple sure that you can defend every step you took along the way.
Great.
And I think, I think is important to remember is sort of the core function of what we're doing, which is discovering. We don't, you know, we need to know that there are things in there that we don't know yet. And your client might be completely assured that there is no private health data in their data set, and you think you can use an AI tool. And then 1 week into going through the documents, there's a ton of health data in there. And now you're in a completely different type of review and have to use the tools completely differently. So I think just remembering that there's always something that we don't know in the documents, and our primary role is to figure out what that is.
Yeah. Tyler, great point. I mean, clients, I've been doing this for 25 years. Clients rarely have a full understanding of what's in their data. And it, regardless of whether it's PI, PHI, or just the general context of the data, you know, it's very true. And that's why the scoping component is just so critically important. And then having, being able to have those communications with the client and with the appropriate, you know, kind of support functions in place to kind of manage that process. So couldn't agree more.
All right, we're going to head over. Were there any questions?
The BBA is Boston's largest legal network built on justice, community, education, and inclusion. Take advantage of our exclusive Express membership offer and save 50% off BBA membership through August 31st, 2024. Enjoy the full benefits of BBA membership and take advantage of BBA programs and events, discounts on services, access to the full Learn Online library, and much more. This special offer is only available through March 15th, 2024. Use code EXPRESS50 at checkout.